focus will now turn to tax. How appropriate if you, like me, are having to write a cheque at the end of this month for whatever reason that they choose so close to Christmas to make you pay the tax, but that's the way it is. We'll hear from the Prime Minister, the Conservative Party's manifesto theme, a Britain that rewards work. It comes as new Treasury analysis shows that by the end of the next Conservative government, a typical basic rate taxpayer will have paid at least £8,000 less in income tax since 2010. In a moment or two, I'll be asking you, is tax something that would actually make you vote a certain way? Obviously, anything that attacks you in your wallet or your purse or in the chequebook is going to be of interest, but if it really, compared to NHS or possibly immigration or possibly Europe, tax, how important a battleground might that be? Let's speak with Priti Patel, who's Conservative MP for Witham in Essex, also a Treasury Minister. And I understand, Ms Patel, you're going to give us an idea briefly of what we'll hear from the Prime Minister. Good morning.
Yes, good morning, Nick.
What will we hear?
So the Prime Minister today will be very much talking about the fact that we're a low-tax party, backing hard-working people and also aspiration, but putting this very much in the context of the last Parliament, this Parliament in particular, the last 5 years, and life after the wake of Labour's Great Recession, the fact that we've had to make very difficult decisions during this Parliament. We've halved the deficit as a percentage of GDP, while at the same time cutting people's income tax. And now we're looking ahead. We're talking about how we will do exactly the same again, eliminating the remaining half of the deficit in the next Parliament and cutting income tax more in the next Parliament as well.
But isn't the reality the only way you can do this, Minister, is because we have debt at world record levels? This country's never been in such debt.
No, on the contrary, I think our focus is very much...
We've got the highest debt figure ever, haven't we?
I've said that we have halved the deficit, but the point is, going into the next Parliament, we're very clear about this. We want to pay off our debts. And that means we've also been clear, working with the Office of Budget Responsibility, we've spoken about the fact that we will also run a surplus so that we start paying down our debts and
which
we'll keep our economy...
Which is the highest it's ever been, though, isn't it? Sorry to talk over you. I just want to nail that point. I'm right to say that, aren't I, Minister?
This is a reality that we still need to pay off our debts. And so we are the only party with a plan as to how we'll do that and as to how we will run a surplus.
But it is the Conservative-led coalition that's got us deeper into debt.
Well, actually, I think we should put this into the context of Labour's Great Recession. This is the wake of the legacy. Labour brought our economy on the brink of bankruptcy.
You went in and famously someone left a note saying, sorry, there's no cash in the till. But then, as a result, and look, the good times have returned. Look at the employment figures. I was talking to your colleague Esther McVey last week, and that's all good news, and businesses are going, and it's all fantastic. But the price to pay is that we're more indebted than ever before, Minister. That's the truth under the Conservative-led coalition, isn't
it? We also have to put this into the context that if we fail to reduce the debt, it will leave Britain in a very vulnerable position should there be any future economic crisis as well, which is why we are committed to running a surplus. You know, these are structural issues relating to our economy that have to be resolved. We've been very clear about how we'd look to run a surplus, the measures that we would take in the next Parliament, which of course is a complete contrast to the other political parties who still have uncosted plans, and yet they are speaking about more debt and also the prospect of more taxes on the family, on homes and on businesses.
Lastly, Minister, does research show that a lot of people might alter their vote concerning tax issues?
Well, I don't think this is about research. My party, the Conservative Party, is the party of work and aspiration, and we believe that people know how to spend their money best, and it shouldn't be up to governments just to take more of people's income and just spend it in an unaccountable way. So for us, it's very much a reflection of what we have done in the economy, where we will go with the economy as well. And actually, this is now the choice at the next election, either to stay with us for economic competence or, you know, go with the other guys who will just continue with debt and the economic chaos that got us into this mess in the first place.
Thanks for your time. It's always good speaking with you, Priti Patel, Treasury Minister. Let's hear now from Hilary Wainwright, founding editor of Red Pepper, an independent magazine of the radical left, also author of Reclaim the State, Experiments in Popular Democracy. How important is tax when people come to vote, would you say? Good morning.
Good morning. I think it's important, but I think the question is who is to be taxed and what for, and whose aspirations are to be nurtured. I mean, I think that people are also concerned about our public services. You know, when education is becoming so expensive, you know, when I was a student, I got a grant and I was part of that baby boomer, very aspirational generation. And our aspirations were supported by public money. Now, you know, it's going to cost $9,000 or more to go to university, and that key moment of aspiration is going to be thwarted for many people because, you know, the way in which the government is trying to cut the deficit is by cutting public services. Now, there is money to be got through taxation to sustain public services, which will then provide people with the means by which their aspirations can be realised. And that is, you know, the very rich. There's this very important report from Oxfam showing that 80 people owned half the wealth of the world. The rest of the
did you say 80? 80?
80 people, wow. Yes, owned... I know, and so there is. We all know if we drive through Hampstead, or you know, you know the wealth that there is even here in London, and it's those people that need to be taxed.
But they are taxed.
Money should then, yes, but they need to be more highly taxed.
Why?
And I think it's a sort of con. It's almost
where can you point to that taxing the rich helps the poor? Show me a country where that's worked.
Well, for example, Brazil. Which is a country that's now been able to... I mean, our levels of poverty, obviously, nothing like...
There's people
like,
dying in the Brazilian slums.
Well, now there's much more just basic income. People get a sort of basic income.
The rich have never paid more tax than they're paying currently.
A better taxation. Sorry? But much better. It's not... I don't want to hold up Brazil as some sort of utopia, but just...
A couple of points. The rich have never paid more tax than they're paying now. And I would argue it's never been shown that by let's tax the rich more, you make the poor better. You don't.
You can. It depends a bit whether you've got a democratic and efficient public service. I mean, you can't do just simply one thing. If you tax better and you get more money, then you've got to have a much more transparent, much more accountable public service where people can actually have some control over how that money is spent. So it's not automatic, but certainly a more redistributive taxation system. I mean, it has got much less redistributive since the sort of 70s, for example, when you know, there was at least some redistribution. Now it's moving in a sort of Hood Robin, you know, the opposite of Robin Hood and the opposite of redistribution way.
All right. Hilary Wainwright, you're founding editor of Red Pepper, which is a radical left independent magazine. Thank you. The idea that we want to tax the rich even more, doesn't that just come down to a degree of jealousy, by the way? If people do well, why do you just want to tax them more? Tax, is that likely to determine how you might vote? There we go, that rather dreary mantra from the left. People who earn lots of money, if you drive through Hampstead, let's just tax those people more. Why? Why wouldn't we try and encourage other people to try and come up and get... Why don't we level up rather than level down all the time would be one of my arguments. Let's speak now with Ryan Bourne, who's head of public policy at the Institute of Economic Affairs. How important, how much distinction will there be between the parties in 100 days' time when it comes to matters of taxation, would you say, Mr Bourne? Thank you for hanging on the line.
Good morning, Nick. I think there will be a fairly big distinction in that this is the first real election in years where the parties are going in with a fundamentally different fiscal approach. If you look at the spending plans that the Conservatives have made, it sort of suggests that they'd need to cut spending by about 33 billion quid in order to finance some of these tax cuts and run a surplus, which they're sort of aiming to do, whereas the Labour plans would perhaps only cut by about 7 billion. So there is a big ideological distinction here. And, hey, I think that's quite a good thing for voters. After years of parties pandering to the same, whistling the same tune, I think it's good that we're getting a bit of choice in this issue because in the aftermath of the financial crisis, I think we do need to think more radically about the sort of future of the state in this country.
What are Labour going to be saying?
Well, I think Labour are going to sort of suggest that we need to perhaps tax and spend more than the Conservatives in order to protect public services. I think those fears are overblown. I think when you look around the world, there's countries like Australia and Switzerland, which have much lower levels of public spending than we've had over the last decade and seem to have perfectly decent public services, don't seem to be horrible places to live. But as I say, I think we'll hear more of these of this sort of scaremongering, not just from the Labour Party, but from other parties too, about public services over the next 100 days.
The reality is, I suppose, people want to know how or where their money is spent. And one of my earlier contributors talked about the interest and the amount of money required for the public services. And, of course, we're looking at perhaps some strike action between now and the general election. How key a factor might that be?
I think it will, you know, be a factor for some people. Everybody has different values. I think there is a big question, particularly for the Conservative Party, in that if you're sort of promising to run a surplus and deliver some tax cuts, but then at the same time saying you're going to protect the state pension, you're going to protect healthcare, you're going to protect much of the schools budget, you know, international aid, and, you know, you're going to have to pay debt interest, which you can't really do much about. If you say you're going to ring-fence all of those things, then there does become a question of, well, where exactly are you going to make the savings? You sort of get to a stage where you're having to cut everything else back pretty drastically to meet those targets. I think, personally, I wouldn't ring-fence so many things. I think that we should be looking at things in the round. But if they are going to do that, then I think it's, you know, inevitable that some people suggest that other public services other than the protected departments will suffer. I happen to think there's lots of things that the state does at the moment which I prefer it not to do at all, but the Conservatives, as of yet, haven't sort of suggested doing anything that radical. So there is a question mark over where these savings will be made if you've got so many protected areas.
Okay, just lastly, I think we heard some of the context of what we're going to hear from the Prime Minister, from the Treasury Minister, Priti Patel, earlier in this hour, and we're going to hear about how the country has been rejuvenated and this is the party that's going to get people back to work and tax less. But the other side is true, is it not, that this Conservative-led coalition, the country has never been so deep in debt?
Well, we have been more deeply in debt after the Second World War. This is the largest debt that we've accumulated in peacetime as a proportion of GDP.
Travel Pack. Have the... This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Into the Celebrity Big Brother house, and it's normal that most years the celebrities clash over something that generates some headlines. I don't think this is quite going to be on the Shilpa Shetty and Jade level, but it still got people talking. It actually happened a couple of nights ago when some of the contestants, and if you don't follow it very briefly, you probably know the idea of Big Brother. Well, they put celebrities in there and they effectively bicker and fight and flirt and everything else that you do with a group of people over a couple of weeks, and various lines emanate from it. Well, this one is concerning Katie Price, also known as Jordan, a woman whose career, by the way, started on page three of... I'm so sorry. I'm sorry, I couldn't avoid that. On page three of The Sun. And if you're wondering, well, all those girls, they get exploited, it's shocking. Ms. Price now has somewhere between £30 and £45 million in the bank. Not doing badly. And that is relevant to this conversation, because she said she's perfectly happy for the taxpayer to foot the bill for her disabled son, Harvey, to be driven to and from school in a taxi every day. She was challenged by Katie Hopkins, of course, no stranger to controversy herself. And Katie Price told them, her and the other contestants, that she's perfectly happy and it's ridiculous for her to pay for a private driver for Harvey, who's 12, who's blind, has autism and other conditions which mean he cannot walk far. And also, poor chap, his condition is so life-threatening, he needs an escort capable of giving him emergency injections to save his life. That is the level of the boy's health, which is very, very serious, of course. He goes on a 100-mile round trip to a special school in Wimbledon, South London, from the family home in West Sussex. Katie Price, who, for your knowledge, is 36, said it would cost £1,000 a day for a private driver to take her and her son to and from his school. £1,000? That's £250 to the school, and then obviously mum comes back and does what mum has to do, and then mum goes... I think that's a bit toppy, isn't it? Oh, here we are. The Daily Mail tells us this is a good idea. A standard return minicab fare between her home and Wimbledon is around £130 a day. I was going to say it seems a lot. Anyway, this is the clash of the Katies. You'll hear from Katie Price and Katie Hopkins.
Because the driver that takes Harvey is funded by the government. Because he has a driver and, like, a nurse that sits in the car with him.
Aww. Oh, that's good.
What if you provided that privately, so you've got a driver and someone?
Do you know how expensive that would be? Ridiculous. To have a driver a day to take me to London and back is up to a grand.
With the amount you earn, I'd find that tricky when you could afford it yourself.
No, but I just do it that way, statementing. It's like, I pay my taxes, so if I can have a statement, I will.
I'll pay my taxes, and I can have the money, I will. I think you probably hear that in A&E's up and down the land every day. I pay my taxes. I want those tests. I pay my taxes. I'm not saying she's wrong. Many people would agree. Katie Hopkins subsequently said on the show, I've always held dear that if you can afford to pay for something, you should pay for that and you shouldn't rely on the government. That's wrong. Miss Price, she has five children, replied she was a taxpayer who paid over the odds rates and her income changed, quotes, all the time, so couldn't be relied upon. The local education authority in question, West Sussex County Council, provides the free transport. It did not comment yesterday. Miss Price has previously said her wealth should make no difference when it comes to raising a child with disabilities. Councillor David Simmons is chairman of the Local Government Association's Children and Young People Board. He joins me now. What do you make of an attitude such as expressed on the television?
Well, the situation from the council's point of view is very clear. The law says that the local council has to make provision for the child to get to school and are not allowed to means test in any way that service. The service has to be appropriate to the needs of the individual child. So in a situation where you have a child who has a life-threatening condition where they need to be attended by a nurse, the council has to pay for that. And I know how frustrating this can be. I've had meetings personally with parents in my own local authority who've offered to contribute financially to the cost, who said they're quite willing to do that. But it's very, very clear that the council is not able either to ask for that or to accept the contribution if it's offered. And it does speak to a much wider debate. Clearly, we need to make sure that every child does have the opportunity to get a good education and a good start in life. But in situations where that can impose huge costs on local taxpayers, we've got to look at the most efficient way of doing that.
All above is correct, sir, and you're right to point it all out. But in your gut, someone who might have 30 mil in the bank, it's a form of abuse, isn't it?
Well, ultimately, the local authority is responsible for the interests of the child. And of course, you know, we all know family situations change. People's incomes go up and down. Who knows what may be going on? The local authority is there to make sure that the child gets the best start in life. That's the duty that's been given to us by the law, and that's the thing that we need to focus on. And we try and make sure that we do that. In London, it's relatively straightforward because of the very good public transport network, and often it can be done quite inexpensively by providing training and support for the vast majority of children to use an Oyster card. When we're talking about some of the big rural areas, that can be a much, much bigger
challenge. But isn't that the reality, councillors? Shouldn't there be, and let's face it, we're talking about someone who fortunately has done very well with her career, shouldn't there be a mileage limit? So for the purpose of debate, I'm going to say that the local authority system will cover 25 miles. There we are, I've made it up. And should you choose to live more than 25 miles, either you're going to have to pay that extra or you're going to have to move closer to the school.
Well, for many children who have really significant health needs, there may only be one school in the whole country.
What, you mean we drive children around the entire country every morning?
We certainly do, yes, sir. Not every morning. So we have situations
where
children may travel from London to residential schools, and again, the local authority has to provide that transport. Or, you know, simply because there are very small numbers of children with very profound disabilities.
Right.
And that transport is the only way.
But would it be wrong, lastly, councillor, to say we're going to put a 25-mile radius around this school, and you can live where, look, you can live in Dumbarton if you like, but you are going to pay? Would that be so wrong?
Well, the consequence of that is we would need to provide an awful lot more very small, very expensive special schools.
No, people would have to move.
The lower cost rate. Well, we could ask mums and dads to move, but of course, in many cases, there are other children in the family who may already be settled in school. They may have responsibilities to the extended family. And clearly, it isn't fair that the impact of one disabled child in the family should be that the whole family have to be disrupted. So we need to find a way to balance that situation as best we can.
Always good speaking with you, Councillor David Simmons. You're chairman of the Local Government Association's Children and Young People Board. It's there if you want it. But should it be? Should you be expected to make some form of contribution? Peter's in Weybridge. What would you say, Peter? Good morning.
Good morning. I've got a severely disabled child who is entitled to transport. Hmm. And I'm with Katie Price 100%, I'm afraid.
Why do you say afraid? Please don't be afraid if that's what you think is right.
Well, I've seen this on the news and I knew it would be a subject for debate and I knew it would be. Look at this woman who's got millions and she shouldn't be getting this. But I think you need to also look, does that mean she's not entitled to go to a hospital and use the NHS because she has money, so she shouldn't use the NHS service? The politicians if they send their children to state schools, they're considered great. If they send them to private schools, which they can afford, they're, you know, people say that that's not right, that their children should integrate. So I feel Katie Price is being rather picked on. What things should she turn down? She should not accept anything. As I say, she should not use a hospital. She should not use anything else.
Well, I know the hospital is quite as similar as having your own driver. Stay on the line, Peter. Sam is in Leeds. Sam, what do you think about this model and actress getting this money?
For model and actress. I think she's a disgrace. I absolutely think she's a disgrace. Why? She doesn't need it. She's entitled to it, but she doesn't need it. Listen, Nick, my mother died 10 weeks ago, right?
Oh, I'm so sorry.
I dropped my wages down from £1,200 a month to £400 a month. I couldn't even get carer's allowance to look after her, right? She got DLA for the last couple of months of her life, right? I spent my life savings keeping her warm. This winter, I can't even put my heating on because I have got no money. And Katie Price is claiming DLA and everything else. But she does not need it.
Just because you've been through so much, it doesn't necessarily mean that everyone should be like that, does it?
No, absolutely not. No. She doesn't need it. It should be an income that should be taken into consideration. If you've got more than £500,000, then you should not be entitled to DLA or other things.
Non-taxable
income.
Sam, don't go. So that was strong words. Peter in Weybridge, I don't know whether you caught all of that, but Sam unfortunately has endured some tough times and has only recently lost mum, but she's saying someone with that money in the bank should be funding this herself. How would you respond?
I sympathise for her situation. Obviously, there's a lot of benefits that are means tested. That's not a benefit, it's means tested. So it's just not a means tested benefit. That's larger argument, as is pensions, winter fuel allowances. Why should old people get them and not disabled people? That's a different argument. There's lots of unfair things. There are reasons why there's transport. It takes a disabled child a lot longer to get ready in the morning. They like disabled children to associate with their peers.
Right.
I think there's more to it.
Here we go. Come back in, Sam.
Why can't she take him herself? She's always swanning around everywhere. She can get the other kids in the car and take him herself. She uses that child, in my opinion.
I'm just going to... I don't really want it to be too personal, because the young man's not here to defend himself. I think, let's note that the issue of transport is OK. I think manipulation of someone with these difficulties, I feel a bit sensitive about, Sam. But okay, don't go. You're still on the line. You're still on the line, and I do, obviously, I realise that the grief is very raw, what you've endured. Let's bring Peter back into the conversation. Sam, although very strong in her views, she's representing a body of opinion here, Peter.
Oh, I'm sure there's a body of opinion. I'm sure that it's very difficult because I think unless you walk in those shoes of caring for somebody that's disabled, you don't see quite...
Well, I did for 18 months, an incontinent mother, a mother that was disabled, a mother that had fits, a mother that had osteoporosis, osteoarthritis, a mother that I had to carry around for the last 2 months of her life. So I know what I'm dealing with.
We can compare symptoms. I'm dealing with that every day as well. I didn't say at any point that I didn't think that you shouldn't have got more support or more help.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
David in Bayswater. Hello, David.
Hi, Nick. I just wanted to ask you a question. How are you going to resolve the issue of the recruitment and retention of nurses, specifically British nurses who leave the profession very quickly, and the crisis in the A&E where patients are getting poor quality care and are dying in our A&Es? How are you going to resolve that?
Well, you need to recruit more nurses, and we are recruiting more nurses, and we've recruited thousands more nurses over the last several years. One of the ways, of course, you've got to do that is by making sure that we protect the funding for the NHS now and in the future. And a guy called Simon Stevens, he's not a politician, he's the sort of independent guy who runs the NHS on the country's behalf, has identified an £8 billion funding gap by 2020. And I think we need to fill that. And my party's come up with ideas about how you tighten up some of the loopholes in the tax system that only benefit the very wealthy and make sure that we link the growth in spending on the NHS to the growth in the economy once we've dealt with the deficit to meet that figure. So you've got to provide money, you've got to recruit more nurses, and of course you need to deal with the very considerable, as you quite rightly said, David, very considerable pressures on A&E at the moment, not least by making sure that we have a more effective way of discharging elderly patients who can sometimes end up in hospital and end up staying in hospital beds for longer than is actually good for them because the social care system, the NHS system don't cooperate as well as they can together, which is why, in fact, I think in a couple of months' time, we're starting something called the Better Care Fund. It's a big pot of money, over £5 billion, which will allow the NHS and local authorities to sort that out more effectively than is the case right now. Are you a nurse, David?
Yeah, I am a nurse, and that doesn't resolve the problem. I said specifically British nurses. We are recruiting from abroad,
yep.
And we do this in cycles. I have been just over 12 years qualified. We recruited 10 years ago from Spain. We recruited 10 years ago from the Philippines. We then moved to Portugal. We are consistently moving around the world to find new nurses because, actually, the care is substandard, and nurses who are British will leave because we feel guilt. We feel unhappiness. I feel sadness when I used to go to work in the NHS.
Are you now no longer a nurse, David? Are you left?
I am a nurse and I'm still on the register. Do you know, Nick, the biggest issue I have, no nurse will speak out about this for one reason. Staffordshire is the reason. We spoke out, nurses spoke out and reported it, and you closed the hospital on your watch. So actually, you've taught me a valuable lesson. Don't speak out. Don't speak about the fact that actually people are dying today in A&Es around the UK. Because when you're at the massive occupancy level that we are at, what happens is you miss things. And I, over the years, have seen things that have been missed. And will we report it? No, because there's only one person in the frame. And that's the nurse and the doctor. No manager has gone to prison over their behaviour. No politician has ever been held accountable. So actually, the crisis is much more serious. And the reason I'm very angry is because it is so serious. And I do apologise if I come across a little angry.
No. Don't apologise at all.
Well, it's
obviously. Well, I'll come in a minute to some of the things you've raised, but don't at all apologise for feeling passionate about something which is of such vital importance. Obviously, you care about it, but we all care about a properly staffed, a well-run NHS. Look, just a couple of points I'd like to make, David, is firstly, we do have a lot of nurses who come from other parts of the world, other parts of Europe, to help out in our NHS. And I don't think we should somehow, deny the fact that they do a great, great job. Lots of them do a brilliant job. And it's one of the reasons why I always think that if you did what UKIP say and large parts of the Conservative Party say, and just pull the drawbridge up, our NHS would collapse overnight, as would our social care system. But I think the point you're making is, how do we make sure we train more British nurses and people who want to go into nursing and live and come from our country? And as I say, more and more nurses are being recruited into the NHS. But secondly, how do we make sure that the pressures on the A&E, which you talk about, are sustainable in the long run? And look, I think there is a big challenge. We've now got, I think it's some statistics I saw recently, 2,000 more ambulance trips every single day, 3,000 more patients being treated within the four-hour A&E deadline per day than was the case even a few years ago. And look, I've alluded to one of the things. I'd be interested to know whether, in your experience, this is one of the issues. That certainly when I visit A&E departments and speak to discharge nurses in particular, they say that one of the biggest problems is not being able to have adequate places to move people out of hospital and back into the community as quickly as should happen. So these are things that do need to be sorted, will be sorted. I don't think that they can be sorted unless we provide the financial backing to the NHS that is necessary in the years ahead. But David, where do you think the source of the pressure on A&E is presently coming from?
When you talk about, I'm not talking about the UKIP agenda, and I hate UKIP with a passion, because my wife is also a nurse, and she's Irish, so she's on the people that they would want to deport or get rid of or put on a work visa. So I have no support for UKIP at all. But the foreign nurse issue isn't that we want to get rid of foreign nurses. The point being is my parents came here from India. My parents were grateful that they came to the UK. I was born here. I am not grateful for what the UK have given me. I want more because I expect more because I was born here. My parents were happy with the status quo. And that is the way many foreign nurses feel. Because if they express an opinion that says, this is not safe, people tell them to leave. And I would ask you a question, Nick. In the last 10 years, why are we having to constantly run abroad? There is a systematic problem, a failure in the management in all of the NHS trusts that have to recruit in other countries. Because, I'll be honest with you, they treat nurses badly. And the biggest issue, the main reason I left wasn't actually, it was partly money, but the bigger issue was guilt. I went home, I had a man who was 92 years old. He was incontinent because of the fact that I took nearly an hour to get to him. The fact is he started crying and I felt bad because actually, you know what, you weren't there. Mr. Cameron is not there. I am the person there that is responsible for making that man cry, in my view, and that I couldn't cope with. And I got fed up with the guilt, going home feeling depressed about my job, and actually decided, you know what, I can go and earn a larger amount of income and actually not have a situation where I feel guilt every night.
Yeah, well, look, David, you put it very powerfully. I'm incredibly sorry to hear, not least for such a, you know, such a noble, if not the noblest vocation of all, nursing, caring for the sick and people who are vulnerable. I you know, it's very distressing to hear that you actually felt guilty about what you were trying to do, because you clearly were trying to do so, you know, with the very best possible intentions. Look, things do go wrong. Things have gone wrong. You talked about Staffordshire. That didn't, I think you just implied it happened on our watch. It didn't. It actually happened under the previous government. But you're right. Then decisions were taken to make sure that it could never happen again. I very much hope that nurses listening to this would not feel in any way discouraged or intimidated for coming forward where they think they've just got to kind of, you know, be open about things that they think are going wrong. And I think the role of whistleblowers in the NHS, whether it's in A&E departments or anywhere else, are incredibly important, because unless people come forward and say what they feel, as you are now, we're not going to make things better.
All right. Mr. Clegg, is Ed Miliband weaponising the NHS in the run-up to the general election?
To be honest, I just don't really know what... I just don't know what Labour are up to anymore. You know, I heard Andy Burnham the other day ranting and railing about having the independent sector and voluntary groups and, you know, private companies playing some role in the NHS, yet it was the Labour Party that actually privatised... In fact, it was on his watch that private sector companies were shortlisted for the only privatisation of any NHS hospital, the Hinchingbrook Hospital in Cambridgeshire. It was the Labour Party that spent £250 million on independent treatment centres, basically private sector operators, to undercut the NHS. So they seem to be sort of arguing against their own record. They haven't actually come up with a plan in the way that I described earlier to meet the challenge set by Simon Stevens on how to deal with the financial pressures on the NHS in the years ahead. They haven't really fully endorsed what I've been doing to put mental health on the same footing as physical health. So, look, okay. I get the impression as a politician, and obviously as a leader of a different party, that what the Labour Party decided to do is they said, look, people care about the NHS, as they rightly do, more than almost anything else. Let's kind of just constantly and somewhat randomly point the finger of blame. And they haven't stopped to think about whether their own record measures up to their own criticisms, and it clearly doesn't.
We move to other callers. Where are we going, Deputy Prime Minister?
I don't know, because I haven't been given another
name. Well, let's go to Ida, and my apologies for that. Just to explain, Mr Clegg is, again, the new age traveller of politics. He's going around the country. I think we find him in the West Country today. You're in Bristol.
I'm in Bristol for a very good reason. Before you so facetiously describe what I'm doing, I'm actually doing something which I'm very,
you
very proud of.
You travel in a dormer before.
No, I don't. No, it's a shame. I don't. But just 20 seconds on this.
Yeah, of course.
Because I actually think it's really important. One of the things I discovered when I came into government was this all-pervasive view in Whitehall that Whitehall knows best, that, you know, decisions about where you invest money locally should be taken by bureaucrats and politicians in Whitehall. And actually, I think that's a nonsense. I think local people, local enterprise partnerships, local businesses know much better about how to spend money to boost growth in the local area. So I'm announcing today £1 billion, which we've extracted from the clammy grip of bureaucrats and ministers in Whitehall and transferring them into the hands of local enterprise partnerships here in Bristol and elsewhere. And I'm here to rejoice in that great news and that great act of decentralisation.
The next call to...
Are you lifted up, Nick?
I am hugely, hugely enlifted and feeling strangely empowered.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
50 years ago today, as we've been telling you through the course of the show, and there is extended coverage throughout the day here on LBC, of the events of 50 years ago, when around 350 million people on TV watched the ship, the Haven Gore, carry the coffin of Sir Winston Churchill along the River Thames. We're taking the granddaughter's pronunciation. At the time of Churchill's funeral, Chris Ryland was then just 15. He hitchhiked from his home in Cheltenham to London and spent hours queuing in the freezing weather to see Sir Winston's body lying in state at Westminster Hall. He subsequently watched the state funeral on TV and saw the Haven Gore carrying the great man on his last journey by water, little realising then one day he would own that vessel. LBC reporter Lorraine Horgan caught up with Chris yesterday.
I was 15 at the time that the news came through that Churchill had died, and I was at school in Gloucestershire. And a friend and I talked about it, and then we'd heard that the public were going to be allowed access to for a lying in state. And so I think one break time we sat down and said, well, why don't we go? So we decided to go on the Thursday, and we hitchhiked to London. And so we stood in a crowd for 3.5 hours waiting to file into Westminster Hall.
So as a 15-year-old, why was it so important for you to be there on that day and be part of that?
I've got to say the 60s was a very political time, and we were actually quite politically minded, even though we were 15. And here's the boat, so shall we...
Yes, I would love to.
shall we go aboard?
Thank you.
This is the hatch here that the Churchill's coffin rested on.
Okay.
And as you can see there, there's the plaque commemorating that.
Could you just read that for us, Chris?
Yes, indeed. During the state funeral on the River Thames, 30th of January 1965, Haven Gore proudly carried Sir Winston Spencer Churchill, KGOMCH, and so Haven Gore sails into history. Not even the Golden Hind has borne so great a man. Isn't that wonderful? I can't say it without a lump coming into my throat. In 2005... somebody phoned me up to say that this boat was on the market. Was I aware of it? And I wasn't at the time. And would I be interested in putting in a counteroffer? And I came down to Chatham, which is where it was at the time, talked to the then owner who'd done an awful lot. In fact, his name was Owen Palmer. He was an Australian. I said to him, look, I'll put in the same offer as the other people, but I will give you the cast iron promise that as long as I own the boat, she won't go abroad. And in fact, I said, I'll move her to London. This, as you can see, Lorraine, here's the wheel. It's the original wheel, all the brass. Would you like to have a go?
I would absolutely.
Yeah, please. Well, please.
Unfortunately, we're not going to go anywhere, but at least I can say I moved it.
Fine. Just at the moment, and you can probably hear the noise in the background, we have a deep clean going on. So all of that's been polished, and we're getting ourselves ready to be absolutely in prime view. We're covering the same route that the boat covered 50 years previously, at exactly the same time, incidentally.
For you personally, Chris, what was it about Winston Churchill that made him that incredible figure that he was?
Well, I think there are two things, Lorraine, actually. I ran a business for really quite a long time, and as with any business, we went through ups and we went through downs. And I came to look on Winston Churchill probably as the world's greatest ever crisis manager. When you think about the stand in 1940 alone against what was at that point an all-triumphant fascism, that's really his absolutely pivotal contribution to history.
That's Lorraine Horgan reporting. Yeah, report. Journalists have a fantastic career, a fantastic time, most of the time. Get to do the most extraordinary things, like kind of get on board the Haven Gore. Or did you notice in one sentence Mr. Ryland, the owner, actually said both? He called it the Haven Gore and the Haven Gore. You're going to hear both, I'm sure, through the course of the day. It doesn't appear that there's one right answer. Now, if you weren't around 50 years ago, and I was, but I have to admit I was a very, very young child, the impact is probably difficult to express, but even I recall there being a strange mood around the nation as we bade farewell to probably one of the greatest Britons of all time. And later in the show I'll be asking, why don't we make 'em, as regards politicians, why don't we make 'em like that anymore? I refer, of course, to Winston Churchill.
In all this moving observance, Britain marks her respect, admiration, and above all, her affection for her greatest son.
I don't think any hyperbole there by Pathé News. Apparently it was a bleak January day 50 years ago today. It's pretty bleak out there again, as the cranes along the Thames dipped as the launch carrying Winston Churchill's body passed the giant metal structures on the wharfs on its journey from St. Paul's Cathedral. On a television programme earlier in the week, Jeremy Paxman, who's clearly a little bit older than me, said he watched the funeral as a schoolboy on television. He was conscious of the comment of his mum, who'd driven ambulances in the war, about Churchill, quotes, "We were so lucky to have him, you know." I very much got that same spirit from my parents as well. So it's a privilege to speak to Winston Churchill's granddaughter, one of his granddaughters, Celia Sands, who joins me now. Thank you so much for coming on the programme. What do you remember of that day? Good morning to you.
Good morning. Well, I remember most of it vividly. There are some sort of blank spots, but basically I remember it with great emotion, with great pride, and with nostalgia. It's such a long time ago.
What was he like as a granddad?
He was lovely. He was the only grandfather I knew, and I thought they were all the same. But he was absolutely very affectionate. He'd had rather a bleak childhood, so he was particularly keen on having a happy family life. And I think after the war, the only people who took him completely for granted were his grandchildren. Even his children were in awe of him.
And was he the sort of granddad that used to play games, or was he a little bit more standoffish? How physical, how approachable was he?
He certainly wasn't standoffish at all. I think that he used to definitely get down on his knees and play trains with the boys. I think, as far as I was concerned, you know, I used to go and help him feed the animals, which was my sort of favourite thing to do. We'd go and feed the fish at Chartwell and visit the pigs. And that was what I liked doing. And then I was lucky enough in his later years to travel with him.
Ah, well, what was that like? Where did you go and what do you recall from that, might I ask?
Well, the first journey I did with him was on an amazing cruise on the Onassis yacht from Athens to Istanbul and back. And that was wonderful. We were on the boat for about nearly 4 weeks, and it was absolutely lovely. And after that, the following years, I used to go with him to the south of France quite often.
Phenomenal capability and ability for work, but also enjoyed sometimes a touch of port and brandy and even champagne, I understand. Is that right?
Well, he enjoyed life in all aspects. He was determined to get the most out of life and to give the most back, and I think he did both. Of course, he did like all these things and wanted everyone else to enjoy them too. He loved sharing the things he loved and wasn't happy if he was sitting around the table if everyone didn't have a glass of champagne in their hand.
Wonderful. When it comes to politicians, later in the show, I'm going to be asking, why don't we make them like that anymore? What would you say to that, Celia Sands?
Well, you never know what's going to turn up, do you? But I think the fact of the matter was that we needed him then. He thought that he had a destiny, but he obviously couldn't have known what his destiny was going to be. But when it came, there he was. And I think he was delighted that he had this role to play. And I mean, he felt that he'd fulfilled his purpose. But now, at this moment, life isn't so bad. And hopefully, if we have another disaster time, there will be another Churchill.
As one of his grandchildren, do you think the nation pays him enough respect, or would you like to see more?
No, I think the nation does pay him respect. I think the fact of the matter is, he's a human being, and the nation is a nation of human beings. And everyone regards him, if they do regard him, in their own way. And I think that it's wonderful. Wherever I go, I find people huge affection and huge respect for him. And the people who remember him, you know, great nostalgia.
Wherever you go, you mentioned there, lastly, where are you going today? What part are you playing in the commemoration?
Well, my cousin Randolph and I are about to go and lay some flowers in front of his statue in Parliament Square in a few minutes. And then there's a ceremony in Parliament where there's going to be a service in the chapel, and then there's going to be wreath laying by his statue in the central lobby. And then we are going on Havengore, the launch that I was on 50 years ago, which took my grandfather from Tower Pier to Waterloo Station. And then, if that's not enough, we're going to Evensong in Westminster Abbey, where there's going to be a service of commemoration after that by the plaque, which says, Remember Winston Churchill.
A busy day.
Full day.
A busy day, but being a Churchill, I'm sure you will carry it through with full aplomb. I hope you get whatever you need, enjoyment, if that's the right word, fulfilment or comfort. Thank you. Absolute privilege. This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC. At 14, Mr. Hirsch ran away from the line that led to the gas chambers and tells us now the story of the struggle to keep alive and what it was like living and working there. We begin his journey at the gates of Auschwitz-Birkenau, the larger of the two killing camps. I should warn you, some of the detail of this report is sensitive, so if you have young ears, you maybe want to listen with them. Here's part one.
I was taken out from Auschwitz on the death march. Outside was minus 23 degrees, cold. We were just in our striped suits, and we marched for about 2.5 days. And anybody who couldn't walk was shot in the back of the head, and their bodies were just thrown on the side of the road. And we, after we stopped in a small town, we were put onto goods wagons and taken to Buchenwald.
So you're going to take us through Auschwitz, through the eyes of a survivor. Let's go back to when you first arrived here. How old were you, and what was your first memory of arriving at Auschwitz-Birkenau?
I came here with 185 children from the orphanage, from the Lodz ghetto. We told to get off the train, and we were about 100 people on a train, on a goods wagons, and we had to stand up. We couldn't even sit down. We were so crowded. And then we arrived here by train in Birkenau, and they told the children to, you know, the adults to get off the train, men and boys on one side, women and children on the other side. And then there was a selection.
Avital, you're the 17-year-old granddaughter of this extraordinary man, and he's going to explain Auschwitz to you, and very kindly you're going to allow us to listen in. What are you preparing yourself now as we're at the gates?
I'm preparing to get a bit emotional. I don't really know what exactly to expect. I know what happened here, but I've never seen it with my own eyes.
And that's what's going to happen. Mr. Hirsch, lead on.
I had the experience from my first camp, never be with children or elderly people. If the German didn't need you, they used to kill you very quickly. So I watched, and all the children from the orphanage and with older men and so on, and children, always sent to the left side, and I knew that's the wrong place to be. And so actually what actually happened, a young mother, she had a baby on her arms, and they wanted the mother, they didn't want the child, they won't try to get the child out of her arms. She started screaming, and the assessment run towards her. Because when even they're going to kill you, they want everything to work right on the selection. And that's when I made my move, and I went over to the right side, because I've noticed fitter men and women are picked to the right-hand side.
So that decision, when that commotion was going on with that mother, your decision to nip into that, that saved your life?
Yes, yes. Me and another boy walked across to the other side. We marched on, and we came to a brick building, and there, as I said, they told us to get undressed. We went into a place where they shaved our heads off, and then...
And they did that to you? They shaved your hair?
Oh, yes. And then they told us to go into the next room with a shower room. That the only shower had in six and a half months. And then from the shower room, we dried ourselves, and we next room we got our striped uniforms. And I also got my number on my left arm, and it's B7608.
And you're rolling up your sleeve now in the freezing cold, so I'm going to see the... And how did they apply that? Oh, my God. How did they apply... Dear God.
This was my name, and that was my... whenever they wanted me, they called me by the number. B7608.
And that's still clearly legible all these years on?
Yes, yes, all these years.
How did they apply that?
They put some holes in first with a wooden pen, and they made the holes, and then they poured some ink on, and the ink went in, and then we washed, eventually, a day later, we washed the ink off. And
how much did that hurt?
It hurt when they did it, yes, sure. And... This number, that's a... I had a number here, and a number of my trousers, and that's my number.
And the people who were doing this to you, were they harsh towards you? Were they?
They were prisoners. The things would... The people that...
So it's fellow prisoners?
Yes, fellow prisoners, yes. You were only known by a number.
Well, we seem to be arriving. We can see the rail lines now, and indeed a carriage. I'm guessing this is where... The trains ended and you were all unloaded. Is that right, Mr. Hirsch?
Yes. Yes, we were all unloaded here. Auschwitz was about 30 kilometres big.
And where we're standing now, this is effectively where it was chosen whether you'd live or die.
Yes.
When you close your eyes, can you see that again in your
mind? Oh, yes, very much so. Very much so. It's a thing I'll never forget. Here stood the three high-ranking officers, which did the selections. And this was the right side. If you got on this side, you had the chance to live. To the left here, you went to the right. The same barracks didn't stand here as it was in those days. Here they showed you to the left, so you... Mostly young people, elderly people, and children, and so on. And they just pointed their finger, and you went left. And then people walked on this road here to the right.
And where does that road take them?
Down to the gas chamber and crematorium.
Is that where we're going?
Yes.
In a way, the Sonderkommando were worse than the Germans.
Well, what option did they have? They had no option. Over there, these were towers all the way around. These big ones.
And what was in the towers? What would you see in there?
A man with a machine gun. Every tower had a machine gun. The fence was electrified. Nighttime, not daytime.
Did you ever see anyone try and get over the fence?
No. But I've seen people hanging on the fence. They had enough. They went up to the fence and electrocuted themselves.
How common was that?
Quite common. Especially in the morning when we went to the bathroom. After coming out from the bathroom, people used to have enough and walked up to the to their fence and electrocute themselves.
Part of the camp is closed today in preparation for the service. So how did you get us in?
I had a chat with a guard and I told him that I was here. And
so you're one of the few who got out of Auschwitz and you just managed to get us back in?
Correct, yeah. Yeah. Yes, I am.
It is truly chilling because we are so alone. There are no other humans for, well, kilometres around.
Yes, it's a very easy, very eerie situation here. And here we see the photographs of the people which were waiting to be actually gassed and burned.
Now, these are particularly hideous photographs. What are we seeing here, Mr. Hirsch?
These are photographs, the only remaining pictures of Auschwitz actually to have been taken clandestinely by prisoners. One shows Jewish women being driven naked to the gas chambers and crematorium, where they were murdered. Other two show the bodies of the people to have been gassed, being burned in the open next to the crematorium 5. And this you can see, women undressed and running into the fire. And here are the bodies of the people which you can see have been killed. And there were thousands of these bodies. And usually they didn't have any room in the gas chambers or the crematoriums, so we used to bring out on the field and burn the bodies on the field. They were just lying, the bodies were lying on the fields here, and that they burned them.
Were babies successfully hidden in Auschwitz?
There was one or two, actually, were hidden. But you also had a couple, a woman couple with the women. And she was very, very brutal and so on. And sometimes she had a leaning towards a woman and she allowed to hide the child.
So there were babies born at Auschwitz?
Yes, but most of them were gassed and burned. But another occasion, a child, I'm sure there was one or two children which got through the system.
That's right.
The truly extraordinary Eric Hirsch.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Ida in Morden. Ida, go ahead. You're through to Nick Clegg.
Thanks. Yes, hello, Ida.
Oh, good morning. I'm rather perturbed about where this £400 in vouchers is going to be given to these expectant mothers for giving up smoking.
Mm.
Now, that's all right in theory.
Mm.
Very good. But the problem is with smoking, it doesn't only affect yourself. You affect others around you.
Absolutely right. This is the idea that women could get vouchers for stores such as Iceland and Argos up to £400, £50 just for turning up if they gave up, pregnant women, I should say, if they gave up smoking before becoming a mum. And subsequently, Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg, your response?
I'm slightly perturbed by this as well, Ida. Not that it's not uninteresting that by providing people with those vouchers, those incentives, they might change their behaviour. I tell you what, I'm slightly perturbed by Ida, is that, where does this kind of end? Do you then give people, cash in hand to just simply provide their children with a healthy, regular meal? Do you then give people checks to make sure that their kids go to bed on time? I'm perturbed, if you like, in the sense that at the end of the day, in any free, open, liberal society, yes, there are things that we've got to try and encourage other people to do, but we also have to just assume that people will take responsibility for their own lives and for that of their loved ones. And it's not for the state to kind of come up with ever more exotic ways of, in a sense, incentivising, or worse still, trying to bribe people to do what is good for themselves and their loved ones in the first place. And so, look, it's an interesting academic study. Do I think this is a blueprint for the way in which we should encourage people to do what they should be doing, you know, for themselves anyway? I'm perturbed as well. I don't think it's the right way forward.
On the subject of individual responsibility, then,
yes.
The television personality Katie Price, it's been revealed that her severely disabled son is taken from her home in West Sussex to a special school in Wimbledon and back again by a minicab that's paid for by you and me off our taxes. Mm. Ms. Price is believed to have somewhere in the region of £35 million in the bank. She says it's about a £1,000-a-day car journey. I'm rather surprised. It's probably about £200. Should the state be paying for that little chap?
I think it's for the local authorities to decide. The local authorities...
Well, you must have a view on the basic idea of it.
I'll tell you exactly what my basic idea is. Is that I think there is a duty on local authorities to decide, case by case, on whether they help out with the costs of, in this case, the education of a disabled child. And in this case, clearly, the approach they're taking is that that should be available universally to...
And should it? Children. Someone with £30 million in the bank.
Well, we've talked about this before. We as a society think there are some things that we provide universally to everybody. I've just spoken to David about the NHS. We make the NHS available to everybody, paupers to multimillionaires, regardless of their wealth, based entirely on need, not on the ability to pay. And I think I totally understand it's a perfectly legitimate debate to be had about where you start introducing means testing or not. I so happen to think that the help that we give as a society to disabled children may well be one of those areas where most people think, on balance, it is better to provide that universally. Of course, it means you then get cases like this, Katie Price. But I'd be pretty reluctant to say on the facts of this individual case, we therefore throw out the idea of universally treating all children with disabilities with the same kind of compassion and support, everywhere we can. But as I say,
move closer to the school.
Hmm?
Shouldn't she move closer to the school? If you're in an unfortunate position where you have a child who has a disability, and apparently there aren't many schools, and that's a whole separate conversation. This school is great in Wimbledon. Well, shouldn't you move within a 50-mile radius or 25? That's not much to ask, is it?
Well, look, we've just talked about, Ida was perturbed, as I am slightly, about the implications, at least, if I won't put it any stronger than that, of the kind of state taking responsibility through the issuing of vouchers for decisions that basically people should take as responsible adults themselves. In the same way, the implications of what you're saying, that somehow we should now instruct parents of disabled children to move house, I just don't know how on earth that would work, whether that's...
So you support Katie Price?
I do support... I support... I'm not going to start now saying on the case of what I've heard about Katie Price's child, we should therefore throw out of the window the principle that local authorities can provide support to disabled children regardless of the income of their parents.
Now, down in the West Country...
By the way, it might have sounded inappropriate. I scoffed earlier when you said, what about... But I thought you were going to start asking me about my own smoking habits again, and that's why...
I was trying to draw a veil over that.
No, you did.
To go back
and No, I don't. But
God
I just...
sake.
In case... Because
you're
I think,
obsessed about...
No,
I'm well, trying to move on.
All right.
You're
right.
Battling the evil we.
Let us move
I
on.
And I give credit for what you're doing.
Let us move
you
on.
You are to be put on a pedestal. Week in, week out, you bring down, you cut down the number of... And there you are mentioning it again. Where are we going next?
I'm my own worst enemy. Kyle in Broccoli. Kyle?
Morning. I'm just wondering, how do you feel about parties like Sinn Féin and SNP being able to prop up a government where they don't represent the views of the UK as a whole?
Yeah, because exactly, we've got all these. There's an absolute cottage industry now of speculation about whether Labour would do a coalition with the SNP, whether Nigel Farage and David Cameron would chum up together in Downing Street in a Tory UKIP coalition. I mean, I have to say to you, as someone who is, if you like, one of the not the principal architect of this coalition. For people who don't like this coalition, just have a look at those prospects. The idea of Nicola Sturgeon or Nigel Farage, basically with the whip hand in Downing Street, I think would make the most fierce critics of this coalition slightly more benevolent in their attitude towards this coalition. Look, let's see what happens. I think the way in which the Labour Party appear to be sort of flirting or not flirting, depending on who you listen to, with the prospect of a coalition with the SNP, the way in which the Conservatives are, furiously both condemning and seeking to seduce UKIP, all pretty unedifying. Let the British people have their choice. I've been pretty open about the fact that I don't think those outcomes are great, nor, actually, as it happens, Do I think a Conservative-only or Labour-only government would be great either? Because the Conservatives would cut too much and the Labour Party would borrow too much.
Who's flirting with you, Mr Clegg?
Well,
all this flirting. Nicola Sturgeon and others. Who's rolling their eyes at you?
Well, I am valiantly and pluckily standing up for what this coalition government has done, much though the Conservatives are seeking to try and pretend that they somehow won the last general election on their own, which, of course, they did not. They don't like to be reminded of that. And I'm actually making the case, I'm being quite open about the fact that I think it's unlikely, alas, at least from my point of view, that I'm going to be the Prime Minister and that the Liberal Democrats are going to win outright. But if that's what the British people say, if they basically say through the instructions they deliver through the ballot box that they want to see Liberal Democrats around the cabinet table, which I, of course, think is a sensible thing, because I tell you, the Tories will cut too much, as I said, and the Labour will stick their head in the sand about the deficit. Then, of course, that's something we'll look at. Not at all costs, of course not. I don't want Liberal Democrats to be in coalition just for the sake of it. I want to do it, as we did last time, for the sake of the country.
Now, while you go around the whole of the country, just about everywhere outside of Corby, to avoid me, Prime Minister David Cameron did come into these studios earlier this week, and I told him about you thought that his concern to have the Greens take part in the debate was rather misplaced. This was his response.
He didn't want the Greens in the debate because, you know, the Greens might take some of his voters away. Well, I understand that, but that's just his self-interest, and he's dressing that up as some high principle.
Ah, so the truth is you didn't want the Greens in the debate. Ah.
Well, since then, of course, the plot thickens, because having expressed this truly, truly moving and touching, dewy-eyed compassion for the fate of the Greens, now David Cameron has said he's now equally worried about the fate of the DUP. I suspect next week he'll be worried about the fate of the monster raving loony party, and after that, when they're in, yes, possibly the Tea Lady. Why is she not in the debate as well? I mean, why don't we just have everybody? I mean, it's just getting ludicrous. This endless ducking and weaving, using other people as an alibi for avoiding something which I think is a simple, old-fashioned principle, is if you've been in power, if you run things, I think you should be held to account. And that's, of course, why, unsurprisingly, I think the Liberal Democrats, myself, should be able to be held to account for what we've done in this government, of course, as well as setting out our stall for the future.
I've got the solution. Get Noel Edmonds to do it and just call it Deal or No Deal. There could be 20 round of you around with boxes.
But the danger with this frankly increasingly sort of laughable way in which the Conservatives are sort of pushing the broadcasters to invite an ever larger cast of people is that, you know, look, just imagine what it's going to be like for the viewing public. I mean, by the time everyone's done their one-minute introduction, the whole nation will have switched over to Coronation Street. And so, look, the regulator, Ofcom, has said, I think they're still consulting on it, but they said, look, the main parties, under their definition, are the Conservatives, Labour, Liberal Democrats and UKIP. And I don't know for the life of me why the broadcasters don't at least include in one of the debates the main parties, as identified, not by me, but the main parties as identified by Ofcom. Have the great smorgasbord one with, you know, everyone under the sun, if you want, as one of the debates. But surely the British people want to hear what, as you know, as an independent regulator has identified, provision at least, as the main parties, you want to hear them up against each other. At least it's also more manageable than this great family photo approach that the broadcasters now seem to be advocating.
Where are we going next, Deputy Prime Minister?
We are going to Chris in Hemel Hempstead. Hello, Chris.
Good morning, Mr Clegg. Yeah, I listened to Prime Minister's question time yesterday. It didn't sound as if many of the MPs were taking part in dry January. But serious, it has become an absolute farce. I mean, yes. You're trying to encourage people to go out.
You try and sit there, Chris, I tell you.
It really shows the worst of MPs. You know, they're sort of behaving like statesmen. They're behaving like overgrown school children. Mm-hmm. Well, I thought this was all going to change.
Well, you know. Yeah, well, it clearly hasn't. No, listen, I mean, Chris, if you found it... did you listen or did you watch?
No, I listened.
Yeah, no, well, if you listen to it, just imagine having to actually sit there, as I do, week in, week out, not able to say my piece and listen to these folks sort of...
Why don't you take your book in?
Well, we did discuss this earlier, whether I should take a book or Danny Alexander tells me that Candy Crush is a great game. I could perhaps catch up a little bit on that, or help with my children's homework by looking at their homework schedule. There are a number of other more productive things I could easily do, but I suspect that. Look, Chris, you are basically right. Joking aside, I think it has descended into the most facile Yabu kind of politics, that the only people who get excited about it are the people in the Westminster Village who sort of think this, you know, this is the whole world revolves around who said what, who made what joke. The vast majority of the British public, if they listen like you, Chris, they're pretty unimpressed. Actually, the vast majority of people don't listen at all. And perhaps that is a, you know, that's a blessing in disguise, because I think if more people did see what happens every half an hour from midday to 12:30 on a Wednesday, they'd be even more kind of disillusioned about Westminster politics than many people already are.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC.
On FM, online, on your mobile, and on digital radio. Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
It was 50 years ago today on the papers report, a bleak January day, and it's pretty bleak out there again today in London, and it's even worse elsewhere in the country. But the cranes along the Thames dipped as the launch bearing Winston Churchill's body passed the giant metal structures on the wharves on its journey from St Paul's Cathedral, writes Simon Heffer in today's Daily Mail. Commentating for the BBC, Richard Dimbleby described the scene. Across the river, even the jibs of the cranes of Hayes Wharf are being lowered in a final salute. Unique, strangely touching, as they bow forward towards the other side of the river where the coffin is going away on its launch upstream. In a controversial programme earlier this week, Jeremy Paxman told how he watched the funerals as a schoolboy on television, and he reported he was conscious of the comment of his mum, who'd driven ambulances in the war, when she said about Churchill, quotes, "We were so lucky to have him, you know." I'm a little bit younger than Jeremy Paxman. I do vaguely remember this funeral, and I certainly know that there were similar sentiments from both my mum and my dad. So, when it comes to politicians of the stature of Sir Winston Churchill, why don't we make them like that anymore? Here's a little bit of the great man in action from 1940.
"I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. We have before us an ordeal of the most grievous kind. We have before us many, many long months of struggle and of suffering. You ask, what is our policy? I will say, it is to wage war by sea, land, and air, with all our might, with all the strength that God can give us. To wage war against a monstrous tyranny, never surpassed in the dark and lamentable catalogue of human crime. That is our policy. You ask, what is our aim? I can answer in one word. Victory. Victory at all costs. Victory in spite of all terror. Victory however long and hard the road may be."
Do you know, even that makes my hairs tingle even now. Incredible. In the first hour of the show, I was privileged to speak to one of Sir Winston Churchill's granddaughters, Celia Sands, and I asked her, why don't we have politicians like that anymore, and what made her grandfather so unique?
Well, you never know what's going to turn up, do you? But I think the fact of the matter was that we needed him then. He thought that he had a destiny, but he obviously couldn't have known which destiny, what his destiny was going to be, but When it came, there he was, and I think he was delighted that he had this role to play, and I mean, he felt that he'd fulfilled his purpose. But now, at this moment, life isn't so bad, and hopefully, if we have another disaster time, there will be another Churchill.
Winston, one of Winston Churchill's granddaughters there, Celia Sands. Michael Portillo is a broadcaster, journalist, and, of course, former politician, indeed, cabinet minister, joins me now. Have we ever got anywhere near to Churchill's stature in the last 50 or 60 years? Good morning, Michael.
Nick, yes, of course, you have once with Margaret Thatcher. And some of the characteristics, I think, are the same. A set of absolutely solid principles on which the person Churchill and Thatcher based their lives. Courage. Decisiveness and the ability to lead. What Churchill added to those, I think, are two things. First, that he was a soldier and a very brave one. And I think Margaret Thatcher always felt the lack of having been a military commander. And the second thing that Churchill had, which I think Celia Sands has referred to, is that the demands that were placed upon him by World War II are incomparable with anything that's happened since.
So he was, in a way, a man made for the times, made for the events.
He was, and he was a man of extraordinary talent as well. I mean, he was a very brilliant writer, and he was a pretty good painter. He had extraordinary general knowledge. He understood the geography of the world, and he understood geopolitics. And that was in his blood from very early on. And I can't emphasize how important that is. I mean, even Margaret Thatcher, and I remember this contemporaneously, when she reached 10 Downing Street, had very little knowledge of the outside world. But Winston Churchill had always had that. I think as a matter of family background, and because of his studies, and because, you know, as it were, the curriculum in the broadest sense, I think, was different in those days.
Celia Sands is suggesting, God forbid events ever went that way and we needed another man or woman again, they would sort of be created. How accurate is she?
That's a splendid hope. I mean, Churchill, of course, had been in the system for decades before he was called upon to be Prime Minister in 1940. And I don't know anybody who's been in the system, you know, for decades or even a decade, who looks like the sort of person who could rise to the challenge in the way that Churchill did. However, I mean, it is quite important to remember that people who are writing about Churchill in the 1930s do so with a combination of mockery and alarm. Churchill was a pretty precipitate operator. I mean, he had been a soldier and he'd had positions. He was First Lord of the Admiralty. And, for example, even before the First World War, he presides over the siege of Sydney Street, where there were a couple, I think only a couple of anarchists, holed up, and he brought in the army and I think even artillery. In the build-up to the First World War, when there's the threat of a civil war in Northern Ireland, he sends battle cruisers to Northern Ireland. And then, of course, he masterminds the disastrous Gallipoli campaign. So in the 1930s, he had a reputation for being pretty reckless and, as I say, a figure who combined comedy with making people very alarmed. However, he obviously had the attributes. He built up the experience. He had the courage that made him a great war leader. And I would just like to, you know, mention this thing about courage. I mean, for example, in 1940, a couple of weeks after France has dropped out of the war, and France has been our enormous, solid ally, and indeed Churchill has been planning to create a single nationality that will unite the British and the French drop out of the war, and Churchill gives the orders, if necessary, to sink the entire French navy so that it will not fall into the hands of the Nazis. And unfortunately, the French do not surrender the navy, and it is sunk. 1,500 French soldiers are killed. Churchill weeps, but he'd had the absolute courage, the absolute ruthlessness to do what was necessary. If the French navy had fallen into Nazi hands, the outcome of the war might have been different.
It's always great speaking with you, Michael. Thank you, Michael Portillo, broadcaster, author, journalist, and, of course, former high-ranking politician. Now to Peter Oborne, the Daily Telegraph's chief political commentator, author of The Rise of Political Lying and the Triumph of the Political Class. He joins me now. Peter, greatest Britain ever we're talking about here?
Yep, no question, greatest Britain ever. And that is a formidable list, which includes Queen Elizabeth the First, who's the second candidate, and Shakespeare.
Michael Portillo makes an interesting point, but he'd been in the system for a number of years, indeed decades, but for the war, we probably would not have made his mark. How accurate is that?
But for World War II, just the way that Churchill has had a stroke, or sorry, his stroke in 1939, yeah?
Yep.
He would be hardly remembered at all. Catastrophic war... Lord of the Admiralty in World War One, when he masterminded the debarque of Gallipoli, recklessly, as Portillo said, and then, of course, a morbidly conservative Chancellor of the Exchequer in the 1920s, when he did what he was told by the Bank of England and refused to take us off the gold standard. And so he was, a sort of lively early career as a journalist. I don't think he ever commanded men, as Michael Portillo said, but anyway, he was a sort of young, dashing young officer for a brief period in the Northwest frontier in the Boer War. So not much. He'd probably be one. He's regarded as a minor, lightweight, a politician of no great consequence.
And lastly, exploring the theme, if you agree, we don't make them like that anymore, if you agree with that. Why might that be, Peter Oborn?
Well, I don't like this plural here, because Shakespeare is... Sorry, Winston Churchill is unique. There's never been anybody like him before or since. With possible minor exceptions in certain respects of a younger Pitt in the mid-18th century. He is completely of his own. Just for one of the thought experiments, supposing he had had a stroke in 1938, Chamberlain would have gone, he would have been replaced by Halifax.
Yes.
In fact, and Halifax would have done a deal with Hitler. We would, but for Churchill's intervention in 1940, Britain would have done a deal with Hitler, just as Vichy forced it.
Peter, always good speaking with you. Thank you, Peter Oborn, the Daily Telegraph's chief political commentator. Check out the book, The Rise of Political Lying, The Triumph of the Political Class.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Joined while that was being played out in the studio by Prime Minister David Cameron. Just briefly, before we move on to matters political, sir, quite recently you were at Auschwitz yourself. It's an incredibly moving experience.
It is something that you've seen the films, you've read the books, you remember watching The World at War when, in my case, you were a young boy, but nothing actually prepares you for the reality of looking at the children's clothes and the suitcases and the human hair and the industrial scale of it all. And it's one of those visits you make and you think about it that day, the next day, and then it keeps coming back and back to you. And, I mean, that's why I think it's so important. I'm about to go to a cabinet meeting where we've got the leader of the Holocaust Memorial Commission I set up, who's going to come and present to us what we should do as a country to go on remembering after these brave survivors have left us, because they've been extraordinary sons and daughters of this country, travelling around schools, talking in schools about what happened, but they can't go on doing that forever.
And just briefly, your colleague Theresa May talked a couple of weeks ago about her concerns of anti-Semitism. That's something which I'm sure you and the whole coalition is aware and I would imagine determined to try and combat it.
Absolutely, and I think part of why remembering the Holocaust matters so much is that it reminds people where anti-Semitism, prejudice, hatred ends. So the two things are very much linked.
100 days to go. Let's move to other matters. 100 days to go to the general election. Various parties coming forward with all sorts of ideas. You've got your eyes all set on apprenticeships, which is an exciting initiative, Prime Minister. But why shouldn't it be the firms that pay for the apprenticeships? Why should it come from central government?
Well, they do pay. Obviously, a firm who takes on an apprentice is making a commitment, often a four-year commitment. But it's right that the taxpayer should make a contribution, because we all benefit if a young person learns a skill, learns a trade, earns money at the same time. You go on, then, I think, to have a better standard of living throughout your life, and we need this country to be able to compete with the best in the world. And so my vision is, as you leave school, you should be either thinking about the apprenticeship route or the university route, and we should have fewer and fewer people leaving school without one of those two things.
The headlines say it's funded by another crackdown on those on benefits. How divisive is this policy?
Well, what we're saying is that the benefit cap, which we set at £26,000, that has worked. It's got tens of thousands of people back into work. But actually, one of the criticisms that I've heard around the country is that people think the benefit cap is too high at £26,000. And many people listening to this programme, sweating every hour that God gives to earn a wage, to provide for their family, and they, you know, they pay their taxes not to sustain people on welfare who could work, but to help those who can't work. And that is what should be at the principle of our policy.
How confident are you that message is getting out there? We still see these stories, as I'm sure you do, your heart sinks when you see these families in various newspapers who seem to effectively have made it into a career. It's a life choice.
Well, I think what's changing is not only the practice, because today, if you want to claim unemployment benefit, you've got to fill out a CV, you've got to apply for jobs, you've got to take a job if one's offered to you, which is suitable for you, or you get your benefits docked. So we've changed the practice, but I think I sense, as well in our country, there's a change of culture too, which is, as I said on the steps of Downing Street on day one, you know, those who can should, those who can't we always help. I think that mentality, that change of culture, is happening in our country, as people just think it is unacceptable to opt for welfare as a lifestyle choice when you can work.
I've had the pleasure of speaking to you through the years now. You used to come and see us in our old studios, and you always do very well on the radio, and I always enjoy having you there. Why do you seem to be fighting shy of a TV debate?
I'm not fighting shy. I just made the point when the broadcasters came forward with their plan. I said, well, you can't have UKIP in if you don't have the Greens in. They're both national parties with a Member of Parliament or two. And everyone said to me, oh, don't be ridiculous, just sign up now. Well, actually, what happened was the broadcasters went away, had a think about it, and they all now seem to agree with me, and the Greens are included in the programme. So it's I want these debates to take place. I think they're better done outside the election campaign, now we know when the election is, but they'd be good if they happened. But there's nothing wrong with making your views known.
No, of course. So it's on now, is it?
I think it is. I think that, you know, they've made good progress. They went a bit further than what I suggested, because they now have said, let's have the SNP and Plaid Cymru. And so that raises the whole question about whether you have to have Northern Ireland as well as Scotland and Wales. But that was their decision, not my decision. I simply made the point about...
Are you happy to draw the line at the Scots, Nats and Plaid Cymru?
Well, as I said, I think it's difficult, actually, given we are a United Kingdom. I don't quite see how you can have Scotland or Wales without Northern Ireland, because we're all part of the United Kingdom. But that, you know, that is their choice to have enlarged in that way. But I think they're making progress, so let's let the talks continue, and I think we'll get a result.
There might be more people in the debate than watching it at this rate, Prime Minister.
Well, I'm not in charge of the viewing figures. If people want to watch a television debate, or if they prefer an episode of Wolf Hall, then that's up to them.
Should Sinn Féin be represented, then?
That's not for me to say.
Well, you must have a view.
Well, I'd simply make the point. As I say, I said, if you have UKIP, you've got to have Greens. The broadcasters went away in their wisdom. They didn't ask anyone about this. They just came forward with their plan for SNP and Plaid Cymru. And I don't quite see, but maybe I'm missing something, how you can have a Welsh party without having anyone from Northern Ireland. After all, the Conservatives, we fight seats in Northern Ireland. But anyway, look, I'm sure they know what they're doing, and they'll come up with a plan.
Yes. You're aware, of course, that your coalition colleague, Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg, comes on this radio station very regularly. He's had views about your stance on these debates.
I have an old-fashioned view that if you run government or help run government, you should be held to account. I don't understand why David Cameron doesn't believe in that simple principle. And actually, I would have been excluded from one of the debates. So the broadcaster's got a difficult job, but they absolutely shouldn't be bamboozled or intimidated by this almost comic game playing from the Conservatives who've developed this really, you know, truly touching concern about the plight of the Green Party.
Prime Minister.
Well, he didn't want the Greens in the debates because, you know, the Greens might take some of his voters away. Well, I understand that, but that's just his self-interest, and he's dressing that up as some high principle. Look, what I want voters, these to go ahead.
If you look at the polls, what voters...
As I say, what wouldn't be fair, and I think everyone accepted my argument, it wasn't a complicated point. The UKIP is a national party with two members of parliament. The Green Party is a national party with one member of parliament. You can't have one without the other. I made that point, and I made the point that the debates are better before the campaign starts, for the simple reason, which I think we're now demonstrating, that when we start talking about debates, Britain's media industry can't talk about anything else. I mean, we're not talking about the health service this morning or education, because, you know...
A point well made. Lastly, if you're a betting man, what would you say the odds you're going to have these debates?
I'm not really a betting man. My father was a betting man. I've been known to have a flutter on some things, but not on
this. What are the odds? Five to one?
I'm not a bookmaker.
You want to talk about other matters. How distressed were you to learn at the weekend, as I'm sure you did, that the people mentioned in the Chilcot inquiry who might have the right to some form of reply, not everybody has yet been contacted?
Well, I can't give a running commentary on the Chilcot inquiry for the very good reason that it is an independent inquiry run by Sir John Chilcot, staffed by civil servants, but I can have no oversight of what they're doing. No. It'd be quite wrong in a way. If you think about it, it's worth pausing. One of the great things about our country is governments can't sort of launch inquiries into their predecessors and see all the papers that the predecessors saw and sort of do what happens in some other countries of sort of endlessly trying to prosecute the ones that came before them. We have a proper separation. So all I know is that Sir John Chilcot has written to me saying the report will not be ready until after the election. I've written back saying I'm disappointed, I wish we could have done this sooner, but he is independent and I mustn't delve into this.
But it's distressing that not all the necessary letters have gone out yet, Prime Minister.
Well, look, it's distressing. We didn't start this this inquiry when the Conservative Party in Parliament first proposed it, because, of course, we put this forward years before it started, and Ed Miliband voted against holding an inquiry on no fewer than four occasions. So if actually people had listened to William Hague, who was the Shadow Foreign Secretary, and others in Parliament, this report would have been published. And all the lessons learned.
You mentioned the health service. You're aware that currently scheduled later this week there will be strikes over pay. What would you say to those strikers? Why can't they have their 1%?
Well, what we've said is that obviously there are constraints in that the more we spend on pay, the less we're able to maintain the numbers of doctors and nurses in the NHS. So what we have said is that the offer is that everyone gets 1%. But what shouldn't happen is getting 1% in addition to the other incremental pay increases that are coming through the NHS. But the reason for that, let me be clear, the reason for that is, we need to keep the pay bill under control because we're putting more money into the NHS. But if you put more into pay, you leave less for patient care, you leave less in terms of the numbers of doctors and nurses, which we badly need in our NHS. So look, I think the people in our NHS are doing a fantastic job. I praise their dedication.
I'm Nick Ferrari. You've been listening to the highlights of my week at breakfast on LBC. I'm back on Monday leading Britain's conversation with the big breaking stories of the day, along with regular travel updates. Have a great weekend and stay safe. This is LBC.